think I can say I'm.
I'm Helen Zia. I'm one of the organizers and founders of American Citizens for Justice, the grassroots organization that led the national campaign for justice for Vincent Chin, who was killed in a hate crime in Michigan in 1982.
Okay, and then if you can just say, we'll do that same thing for Wen Ho Lee. However,
I'm Helen Zia. I'm the co-author with Wen Ho Lee of his story, My Country Versus Me.
Okay, maybe you just say the book.
Okay. Yeah. Start again?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm Helen Zia. I'm the co-author with Wen Ho Lee of the book, My Country Versus Me, the story of his persecution and prosecution by the U.S. government.
Excellent. Okay. Let's talk a little bit. No, we'll start with Vincent Chin. Give me a little background about the Asian community in Detroit and the trend that had existed for a long time towards assimilation.
The Asian American community in Detroit and in Michigan was quite small up until the recent decades. And there were Chinese Americans and Japanese Americans primarily who had first arrived in Michigan in the 1800s, really, but didn't so much settle there until the 1940s, 50s, 60s. Japanese Americans came partly after being evacuated and incarcerated in the West Coast during World War II. And Chinese Americans had slowly moved to Michigan. There was a Chinatown, actually, several Chinatowns that kept being relocated because of different freeway projects that kept moving Chinatown. But there was a population. It never really exceeded maybe a couple thousand or, you know, perhaps a few thousand in the entire Detroit metro area, which, you know, was greater than a million in population. So it was a fairly small size. Many of the people in the Asian American community worked in service industries like laundries, restaurants, and a few began to work in the auto companies themselves as immigrants who came over to do research and engineering for the companies.
And would you say there was a feeling that if you kind of keep your head down, you can make it in America? There wasn't, well, you tell me, that to some extent people bought into the model minority idea?
Well, the model minority, the notion of the model minority really didn't begin until 1966. And of course, what was going on in 1966 were the urban rebellions and the civil rights movement. And Detroit was definitely hit very much by that whole revolution, really, that took place across the country. Asian Americans, being in such small numbers, were affected by the same kind of discrimination and racism that took place, but because the numbers were so small and so isolated, never really had the same kind of momentum that took place. And so, you know, the term itself, model minority, really can be pegged with a time and a place. You know, U.S. News and World Reports and the New York Times in 1966, when Asian Americans were presented as the model minority in articles that were not written by Asian Americans. Up until then, you know, the Japanese Americans were the enemy. And as the Cold War continued and China became communist, Chinese also were deemed as the enemy. So up until that point, there really was no model minority. It was Asians as the aliens, alien enemies. And so for well into the 20th century, Asian Americans had to pretty much keep their heads down. And so the attitude was more a question of trying not to make waves, of trying to stay below the radar so that the kind of lynchings that people associate with the South and African Americans, which also took place toward Asian Americans, would not happen. So there was a feeling of just trying to lie low. And assimilate is actually a stronger word, because up until that point, there wasn't even a imagined notion that you could be, accepted into the American society. College graduates, who graduated from Berkeley or in California, the very few Asian Americans who went to college had no notion that they could go into a profession. They were often told, why are you studying, English or the sciences? There's no way you'll get a job. The best you'll be able to do is be a farm worker or a laundryman like your parents. So it really wasn't until the civil rights movement that the whole notion of Asian Americans as something that could, be assimilated into American society took place. But that did happen. And so that added a sort of another path for Asian Americans, the idea that, another reason to lie low and be quiet, because if we stay below the radar, maybe we can even be accepted as the good minority, whereas before Asian Americans really were another bad minority. So the civil rights movement had the effect of splitting off, Asians from African Americans in the sense that Asians might be more acceptable as neighbors or as coworkers.
You did work in the, as I remember, in the Chinese community in Detroit, right? You were doing community activism. And what would you say, how would you characterize the sentiment? You've done a very good job of painting the background and the trend. So what was the sentiment at the time, let's say in the early 80s, just before the Vincent Chin case?
By the 1970s and the early 80s, the idea of a model minority had pretty much penetrated Asian American thinking as well, buying into this notion that, if having demonstrations and urban rebellions and lawsuits were part of being the uppity minority, then the model minority behavior was to be quiet and to just work hard. In fact, the U.S. News and World Report article said, by dint, here is a minority that will get ahead by being quiet and by dint of their own hard work will get ahead. And so there was a notion that that's what needed to be done. And so by the late 1970s, people were told, I was told growing up, don't make waves. Don't be the nail that sticks up. You'll get hammered down. Look what happens to people who raise their voices. Terrible things happen. And so by the 1970s, people were rather unprepared overall when the second Arab oil embargo happened and suddenly Japan also became the enemy again. Now, there were pockets of organizing, resistance, struggle. During the Vietnam War, especially among students, there was the younger generation saw that other Asians in Asia, in Vietnam, were being treated, were the enemy, were on the evening news every night about how many gooks were killed, how many VCs, how many Charlies. People would come back. I grew up outside of Fort Dix, New Jersey, and in my hometown there were lots of military people, and you could not walk around without feeling like you were the enemy. And so a lot of young Asian Americans of my generation during the 1960s and early 1970s really did try to organize a notion of Asian American as having a voice of resistance and having a critique of racism and looking for a society that joined with other people to fight for equality. So that was a notion there. But for the broader Asian American community, there that really wasn't on the radar screen.
Excuse me. Very succinctly, remind us of the political climate in Detroit in the early 80s regarding the bashing of Japanese, the bashing of the hatred that was being whipped up around foreign competition to Detroit cars. Let me just get this here.
And do you want me to make these references to myself? I mean, is that okay?
That's fine. Okay. Of course, yeah. Feel whatever you feel
okay.
comfortable with, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. By the mid-1970s, there had already been the first, what's known as the Arab oil embargo, the Arab oil crisis, when gas prices went, what, from 19 cents to more than $2 a gallon. That subsided. Detroit went to business as usual, making the big gas-guzzling dinosaurs that it was well known for. But by the late 1970s, there was another Arab oil embargo, and this was really the death knell of the auto industry that made up, you know, 99% of the jobs in Detroit, in Michigan, and throughout the Midwest. I happened to be in Detroit then to go there for the great American adventure, and I was working in an auto plant at the time. I was one of the hundreds of thousands of people who got laid off in the late 1970s, and it was devastating. Everybody was not only jobless, but had no prospects of any work in the future. So people who had worked for an entire lifetime now were virtually penniless. And this created enormous, as you know, anxiety and looking for somebody to blame. And the scapegoat became very quickly Japan. And it was because of these fuel-efficient, small imports that really Japan and Volkswagen had created. But Japan had really made the dent in the market. And so suddenly, with all of these unemployed, terribly miserable, you know, feelings out there, it was quite violent toward Japan and anybody who looked Japanese. So what would happen is people actually took their guns out and shot cars on the freeway. If they were Japanese cars, you couldn't be sure what condition the car might be if you left it on the street or in a parking lot. There would be Japan car bashing events where a Japanese import car would be there, and for a dollar you could take a swipe at a car with a sledgehammer. And these would attract enormous groups of people, and having a face that looked Japanese, and I'm Chinese American, but anybody who looked Japanese really was walking around in fear, because you never knew who might take out their own anguish and anger and hatred against you personally.
Tell me what happened. You were in Detroit when the murder of Vince Chin actually took place, right? Tell me what your first memories were when you first heard about it. What did you hear had happened, and what was your reaction?
I remember very clearly when the news came out of Vincent Chin's killing. It was on the front page of the newspaper. And it was a feature story about a terrible tragedy. Here, this young Chinese-American man, 1 week before his wedding, was out for his bachelor party, had encountered two men who then beat his head in with a baseball bat. And instead of his 400 guests going to his wedding, they went to his funeral. And that was pretty much the gist of the story. There was really nothing about it that, you know, talked about what led to his killing, what the incident was about. But my immediate reaction to that was, there's more to this story. There can't be all of this looking over your shoulder and fear and knowing that these bullets are flying and all this hatred going around without something more to it. And I cut that article out because I just, in my heart, I knew there was something more. And I later learned that I wasn't the only Asian American in Detroit that had that reaction. Just about everybody did, because they knew that things were not right in this city and it was ripe for something horrible to happen.
What did you learn subsequently that indicated it was more than just, as you described, that kind of a tragedy?
Vincent was killed in June. 9 months later, in March, another story came out in the newspapers. And actually, this one was in both of the daily newspapers, and it was about how two killers received probation for a brutal beating. And as I read the story, it was clear that it was the killers of this Chinese-American who admitted to the killing. They pled no contest. There was no question. The beating had been in front of a crowded McDonald's after a Detroit Tigers game, and there were at least 60 eyewitnesses to the killing, including two off-duty police officers. And so there was no question about the killing. And here, after bashing his head in with a baseball bat, these two men walked. They didn't spend a day in jail. And in fact, what they got was $3,000 of fines each, which they paid. You know, the judge gave them very lenient terms to pay it off. So the article was about what appeared to be a miscarriage of justice, something that just didn't sit well. And as I read it and realized that this was the man I had had known there was something more to this 9 months ago, my blood began to boil. I just saw something is really wrong here. There was more to this. The story itself, they really didn't explain what the circumstances were. So at that point, there was no indication that it was potentially a race-related hate crime. But I immediately began to wonder about it.
Now, is that the point at which the Asian community became outraged when the sentence was handed down, or had there been any organizing prior to that?
Prior to that point, most people thought that justice would be served and were willing to let the wheels of justice go their way. And I think that was part of the learning experience for Asian Americans, too, to realize, you know, as other communities have learned, that you can't just leave things up to the justice system. So, in fact, there wasn't any community involvement, even though there was a deep feeling throughout the Asian Americans in Detroit that there was something up with this case. So that's when people began to mobilize. It was really with the news of the probation of these men, people started asking questions and reaching out to each other.
Now, as I understand it, the defense committee that was formed did not initially say this was a hate crime. Well, why don't you describe what the position was and why was there a reluctance to call it a hate crime?
With the community really having no experience, and when I say the community, not just the Detroit community, the Asian Americans across the country really did not have any experience with hate organizing around hate crimes or civil rights issues. And there was no organization in Detroit. It was just individual people who began to contact each other to see what could be done. There was no information whatsoever. Part of the problem in Vincent Chin's case was that there was no real prosecution. There was the police, every step of the way, the criminal justice system had failed this victim. There was no investigation. The eyewitnesses at the scene were never interviewed. So So part of the effort had to begin with, what do we do about this? And so we first started with a couple people getting together. I contacted one of the people whose names I read in the newspaper. He arranged for a meeting with a local attorney, and the four of us met. Then we organized a community meeting that had about, you know, a dozen or 20 people. In those couple dozen people, Mrs. Chin, Vincent Chin's mother, was there, another relative, and all of the Asian American attorneys in Michigan were in that meeting. That was about 10 attorneys, and none of them had experience in civil rights law. So in that meeting, we began to talk about what could be done. And we began to discuss how do we reach out? We don't have experience in this. The attorneys said that once, generally speaking, a sentence is rendered, that's it. there's nothing you can really do. And we talked about going to the judge and seeing if he might reconsider his sentence, and we pursued that. We talked about reaching out to other legal organizations. We talked about reaching out to civil rights organizations, to the African American community, the Jewish community, and the Arab American community. And we began there, to various church organizations. And that was the beginning. There were, at the time, two national Asian American organizations, the Japanese American Citizens League and the Organization of Chinese Americans. They didn't really have much of a presence in Detroit. And truly, there was no advocacy group there for us. So we began the process of from, you know, the bootstraps of thinking like, okay, how do we form an organization and how do we start talking about civil rights? And that was really breaking new ground because, you know, up until this point, especially after World War II and the incarceration of Japanese Americans and the, you know, all the Red Scares of Chinese and Koreans and Vietnamese and being made the enemy, people really were not in these communities, were not, number one, they weren't connected. And number two, they really weren't geared toward organizing around civil rights. People didn't talk about civil rights for Asian Americans. So that became the first item on the agenda. There was a strong feeling that we had to fight for justice, that you can't just go around killing Asian Americans with baseball bats and getting sentences of probation for people. There was a strong sense that what happened to Vincent Chin was like giving a sort of a free pass to anybody, you know, who wanted to go kill Asian Americans. And we had to do something about that. So the discussion began. And how to talk about civil rights was part of it.
This excellent description. I know. I'm already hearing some of the parts I'll be able to use. But if you can describe, I want to zero in on the issue of why it was not considered a hate crime. Because in retrospect, it seems obvious that it was. But I guess at the time, had it been that the witnesses had not yet come forward, or what was it? How would you characterize the position that the committee put forward initially? They just wanted justice. They wanted the sentence overturned and a stiffer penalty.
Well, at first we felt we had to do some fact-finding, that we couldn't just say civil rights or racism. People were reluctant to do that unless they had some evidence of that, though I think all of us, certainly for myself, I felt that there was enough in the hostility and the climate out there to make a case for it. But we began to interview some of the eyewitnesses ourselves, some of Vincent's friends who were there. He had been at a strip joint for his bachelor party, so we talked to some of the dancers, the staff who were at the bar. And what became clear was that not only was he singled out, Vincent and one other Chinese friend of his, as well as a handful of white Caucasian friends of his who were at the bar of this group, only two of them were singled out, and that was Vincent and his Chinese friends. And Vincent and his Chinese friend were singled out. And one of the dancers at the bar heard very clearly when Vincent was attacked by Ronald Ebens and Michael Nitz. They said things like nip, chink, and then said, "It's because of you motherfuckers that we're out of work." And the dancer at the bar heard that very clearly. She told us that and later testified in court that that's what she heard. And with that, the Asian American community felt like we knew what happened at that point, that these killers had watched Vincent and his friends enjoying themselves at you know, a strip joint. They were having a good time. Vincent was the upcoming groom. He was the groom-to-be. And so he got a lot of attention, and that's what started the anger flowing and the hostility from these two men, one of whom was a superintendent at a Chrysler plant, and the other had been an auto worker himself. And so here in this climate where they were bashing Japanese cars and directing all this hatred toward Japanese people, unfortunately, Vincent was there, and these killers saw red. And after chasing him through the streets of Detroit, found him and beat him to death with a baseball bat. So we were able to attach the words with the men, and then the community, people who were reluctant at first to talk about civil rights, began to say, okay, all right, this looks like we can now talk about race. And that was not an easy discussion. A lot of people who very much felt that they should lie low, don't make waves, were not that comfortable even using the word racism. We had a community meeting of 200 to 300 people who were assembled at the Ford Motor Company World Headquarters cafeteria on a Sunday. And a representative from the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division came to talk to us about what's involved in a civil rights case. And people stood up and said, if we want to bring a civil rights case forward, does that mean we have to talk about racism? And some people there quietly, calmly said, you know what? That is what civil rights involves. It is about talking about racism, and what happened to Vincent Chin was a racist attack, and we have to talk about it. And that was the beginning of a dialogue, really, not just in Detroit, but Detroit was the epicenter, but that then spread across the country. It spread to the West Coast and to all of the different Asian centers in the West Coast. It spread to New York, to Washington, Philadelphia, to the different Asian American communities there. It actually spread internationally because the case was watched very closely in Japan, of course, with all the Japan bashing that was going on, in China, in all of the Chinese language newspapers, throughout the Chinese American diaspora, because Vincent Chin was Chinese. So this discussion about race, racism, civil rights, and Asian Americans began in Detroit with tremendous repercussions.
Again, if you can briefly summarize what happened with the first and second federal trials.
Oh, I want to get back to your other question, though, too, about how it was not viewed as the ACLU and the
National. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. Continue on that then.
So as the Asian American community began to look at a civil rights investigation, to press forward with that, to contact the...
Hey, how are you doing? Okay, so you were explaining about the ACLU and some of the other groups' view towards the issue of whether it was a hate crime.
When the Asian American community then began to take up this issue of civil rights and to pursue a civil rights investigation on Vincent Chin's behalf, we ran it right into a wall that was pretty much unexpected from the from people we thought would be our allies, from the ACLU, from the National Lawyers Guild, from constitutional law experts, who basically said that because Vincent Chin was Asian American and because there were no Asian Americans on this continent when civil rights laws were first promulgated in the 1860s, which was also very not true. But because of those reasons, they didn't feel that Vincent Chin would be or should be protected by federal civil rights law. And in fact, the Michigan chapter of the ACLU strongly urged us not to take this up. A the local chapter of the National Lawyers Guild said, we would not support you if you pursue a civil rights case. The idea being that Asian Americans, who they saw entirely as new immigrants who didn't exist in America before, should not be protected. So we thought that this was incredibly, well, not just absurd, but it was really hard to hear it coming from these quarters. And we thought, okay, then we're going to have to pursue this without them. And we found a lot of support, on the other hand, from African-American groups, from various ecumenical Christian, Muslim, Jewish organizations. The Anti-Defamation League stepped in with big support. And we began to take this up. Now, interestingly, it was the local organizations, the Midwestern groups of the ACLU and the National Lawyers Guild, that took this position, partly because they were totally ignorant of Asian Americans and strangely taking a very narrow view of civil rights law and who is an American and who would be protected. In the West Coast and elsewhere, this created an enormous debate within the National Lawyers Guild. At their national convention, the California National Lawyers Guild put forward a proposal, you know, saying that the National Lawyers Guild nationally should support this as a civil rights case, and they did. They voted to take this up nationally, which of course then led to a different conflict on the local level. But as it turns out, the case proceeded. And even now we're talking the early 80s, and even in the Department of Justice under Ronald Reagan's administration, they saw that federal civil rights law should be applied to protect Americans no matter what ethnicity or country of origin they came from. And so it did become a federal civil rights law and began that process through the courts.
I'll probably use the following section just for informational purposes, and then we'll come back to analyze it in a second. So
okay.
If you can just very briefly state what happened. It went to the first trial. There was a conviction on one count, but it was overturned on appeal, went to a second. You know, just give me a kind of a straightforward account of what happened in the federal trials. Do you remember?
Oh, I remember. I'm just trying to get the year right. I think it must be 1984, but I, you know what? I could be wrong. The first trial.
Just say, don't use a year.
Okay. So the federal government took this on, decided that it was worth prosecuting, and there was a federal civil rights trial that actually took place in Detroit. It was huge news. A jury of 12 jurors was seated of people from all walks of life throughout Detroit. And after hearing all of the evidence, they decided that Ronald Ebens, the man who wielded the bat that crushed Vincent's skull four times, was guilty. They did not find that there was enough to convict the other man. And so there was a finding of guilty of violating Vincent Chin's civil rights. So Ronald Ebens was sentenced to 20 years in prison for that. That case then was appealed. And part of the basis of the appeal was that there was too much pretrial publicity, as well as some evidentiary issues that happened. And so it went to appeal, and this time the case was moved to Cincinnati, which was a very different kind of venue to have
I'm
the
sorry,
case.
If you don't mind, just say that it was sent back, it was overturned, the conviction
right,
was overturned,
right,
and then
right,
moved.
Right.
If you don't mind just
right.
adding that sentence.
So the defendant won on appeal. The sentence was overturned, and the a whole new trial was ordered. And so a new trial was to take place in Cincinnati. And this time it was just with the one defendant, the one killer, because the other one had been found acquitted in the first trial. So then it was moved to Cincinnati, which was a whole different location. Cincinnati is really part, even though it's in Ohio, is part of the South. There were as few Asian Americans as there are in Detroit. There were even fewer in Cincinnati. I sat through the jury voir dire in Cincinnati, and they screened some 200, 250 potential jurors. And one of the first questions they were asked was, do you know any Oriental people? And out of 250 people, 19 people raised their hands. Only 19 had ever been to a Chinese restaurant or had any Asian American neighbors, Oriental neighbors. And of those 19, they were then called up and treated as though they were criminals for having ever known an Oriental person. And so that was the beginning. And they managed to seat a jury of 12 people, two alternates of people who didn't know any Oriental people. And the foreperson of the jury was a laid-off factory worker who had a profile incredibly similar to the killer, Ronald Ebens. And not surprisingly, that jury did not believe that it's because of you motherfuckers that we're out of work had any racial content to it all. And they acquitted. And so they acquitted Ronald Ebens, and he was then freed. So the sad ending to this civil rights case was that the killers of Vincent Chin really never spent a day in jail. Vincent Chin and his widowed and then alone mother really saw no justice for Vincent Chin. And that was the sad ending to that story.
It's been now 20 plus years since the murder itself. And it's somewhat contradictory that this very significant movement was developed calling for justice for Vincent Chin, but the killers, as you said, never did any time in jail. Looking back on it, do you think it was a victory, a defeat, or how would you characterize the struggle and the movement?
Well, even though there was a sad ending in terms of no justice for Vincent Chin himself, there was an incredible legacy left behind. And so I believe, and I think everybody who had anything to do with this this campaign for justice really believes that it, number one, not only did it have to be done, but the outcome, there is a good ending to this too, in that several important things came out of it. Number one, it really politicized an entire community to understand, you know, the whole notion of civil rights and civil participation, and that in order to have our rights, any of us, that we have to be involved and we have to be willing to step forward and we have to build alliances with other organizations and to see ourselves as part of a broader historical struggle. And I think that was one of the things that happened. Another was we began with no institutions whatsoever, no advocacy groups, no organizations that could take on a case like this. Now there are dozens of organizations, including a national organization, the National Asian Pacific American Legal Consortium, several legal organizations that monitor for hate crimes, that advocate on behalf of hate crime victims, educate on anti-Asian violence, you know, which Vincent Chin's case was the landmark case that gave a name to that. So all of those things came out of it. It's politicized generations. It's now been more than 20 years since Vincent Chin was killed. And so many generations of young people have come forward who want to dedicate their lives to civil rights and legal rights on behalf of all people because of the Vincent Chin case. So those are things of an enormous legacy that live on and really make us know that Vincent Chin did not die in vain.
That last section was very eloquent, but you said so many generations have come forward. I think frankly, I think it's probably been one generation or 20 years.
Or maybe
say so many people. If you just
so
want
many people.
Just phrase that in a way and have the same sentiment, because it's a wonderful sentiment. I want to use it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we can...
Can I just begin with that?
Yeah, just give me a sentence. Just give me a sentence that says so many people have come forward since there's something. Yeah, just a sentence, and then I'll splice it together.
So many people, so many groups. I mean, I actually do think of it as generous. So many cohorts of college students, but so many people have come forth. Young people, immigrants from other countries, look to this case as inspiration for them to commit themselves to fighting for justice on behalf of all people, for fighting against anti-Asian violence, for making lives that stand for civil rights and human rights.
It's fine. It'll work. Excellent. Thank you. On to the Wen Ho Lee case. How did you become involved in that case?
I first became involved in the Wen Ho Lee case when I read the New York Times one morning, and the front page of the New York Times back in March 1999 had a story about a Chinese-American spy who was identified, but they didn't name his name in the story. What they did say was that he was the worst spy since the Rosenbergs in the 1950s. And of course, the Rosenbergs were executed, traitors to the country. And here was an article that was not only about this man, but talked about how Chinese Americans were really, Chinese Americans were generating all these spies in America. And quite frankly, this story signaled to me just something's happening here. Where is there a witch hunt going on? Because, you know, here was unnamed sources who were saying that this was the spy worse than the Rosenbergs. We had just finished 2 years of a complete demonization, all these innuendos of Asian Americans, especially Chinese Americans, in the campaign finance scandals that went on during, the first and second Clinton administration. I'm sorry, I should probably summarize that.
No, it's okay. When did you actually? So that was when you first became aware of the case. Mm-hmm. When did you actually get involved with the Lee family, and what did you do?
After I started watching this case, from what I had read, from what had all that had preceded it, I first came out with a public statement. There was a press conference that was happening at City Hall in San Francisco to say that whatever accusations there were against this man named Wen Ho Lee, and by this time we knew his name, whatever accusations there might be, that he was entitled to a fair trial without prejudgment. And the New York Times article and every subsequent, story that came out had pretty much convicted him in the media. And so there was a press conference to just say that people are entitled to a fair and impartial hearing of the facts before we prejudge this man. So I went to a press conference and made a statement to that effect. And it was there that I first met some relatives, some nieces and nephews of Wen Ho Lee. And through that contact, later met Alberta Lee, his daughter. And that was the beginning of becoming involved in this. I attended some different rallies. And at this time, you have to remember that, these were top secret allegations that were made. The government wasn't releasing any information. The people who were accusing Wen Ho Lee were still unnamed sources. And so there were very few facts about what it was that he had allegedly done. But everything about it was saying that he was guilty, 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 and of treason, espionage, a capital offense. So all of the organizing that was being done was really to say, give this man a fair trial, and let's get the facts out, and let's not paint every other Asian American as a potential spy, which was what the momentum was at this time.
The Vincent Chin case, the organizing that went around it, was kind of the classic civil rights and anti-war kinds of act. You form a local committee, you go out, you hold a rally, you press conference, whatever. My sense in the Wen Ho Lee case is it was somewhat different. The support was there, but and there were some rallies. But can you compare the two and the kind of people who supported Wen Ho Lee who maybe were not involved in the Vincent Chin case?
There was a big difference between the two. One, we can look back now and say that Wen Ho Lee was victimized. He was persecuted unjustly. But at the time, people really did not know who Wen Ho Lee was, what he may or may not have done. There were these incredible allegations about them. And Asian Americans had experienced the whole, World War II and the McCarthy era Red Scares and Vietnam and Korea about being the enemy. So somebody who is being accused of attacking America, whether as a spy or today as a terrorist, of which Chinese have already been accused of being terrorists as well, that this was something that a lot of Asian Americans were reluctant to get involved in. Vincent Chin was a victim. He was clearly a victim of a civil rights crime, a hate crime. People saw that that could have been anybody. It could have been one of my brothers, my father, me. And so people really identified with the possibility that that could have been them and that that was wrong. Wrong on the basis of anybody's race, color, religion. And so that, in a way, was a much more classic kind of civil rights case. With Wen Ho Lee, it was this man potentially a criminal himself? And so fighting for the rights of a potential criminal for a fair hearing was something that was of a different degree, and not everybody could comfortably join in on that. Some of the organizations that exist, and now 20 years fast forward, there are a number of Asian American, 20 years fast forward from the Vincent Chin case, there are a number of Asian American advocacy groups. Some of them don't want to be involved in issues related to Asia or sort of old country issues, that they see their issues as being American. And so here was a case also involving, was there a connection to China and spying for China? And that also caused some groups to hesitate. But what happened was, as the facts began to unfold, as Wen Ho Lee's lawyers were finally able to mount a true defense and get, the information of what he was accused about, who was making the accusations, entangled this web of secrecy. As they were able to do that, it became clear that Wen Ho Lee was being singled out, and people began to really feel that something wasn't right here. Not only that, but there was a Wen Ho Lee effect. There were other individuals who were being called in to the FBI to be investigated. If Wen Ho Lee was a spy, what about every other Asian American? Not just other Chinese Americans, but other Asian Americans. Anecdotally, I began to hear cases of people calling me up and telling me, so-and-so's father, a Korean American, was called in by the FBI. So-and-so's family is being charged with industrial espionage, okay, by their companies, not by the FBI. And then their companies would call the FBI in. And this had been going on. Other scientists who worked for the government or in defense industries were suddenly being watched. And so there was a real Wen Ho Lee effect that started going around the country. And so anybody who was a little reluctant at first began to see that, we really have to take a stand on this because this is way beyond one individual as well.
Looking back on it now, why, and having written a book about it, why do you think the government chose to go after Wen Ho Li, given the flimsiness of the evidence?
Well, I sat through and, well, I read all of the court proceedings and sat through a number of them. And it became very clear after I spoke to his co-workers, other scientists, Asian American and non-Asian, at Los Alamos National Labs, that in the work group of 70-some other scientists where Wen Ho Li worked, which was cited as the where the leak had taken place. We don't even know that there even was really some sort of leak that happened. But where the site where the accusations were made, there were 70-some scientists, and Wen Ho Li was the Chinese-American. His defense attorneys have said that there were a handful of other scientists, maybe a dozen or so, who had the same, quote, profile as Wen Ho Li, who had visited China on lab business, as Wen Ho Li had done twice in his life. Wen Ho Li wasn't even born in China, you know, but so there were a number of other scientists who had done pretty much the same kind of access, the same kind of access to China, the same kind of access to the codes that he had allegedly mishandled. But none of them were taken seriously as suspects. None of them were investigated. Wen Ho Li was the only person that the government ever investigated. And that's because he fit the profile they were looking for. He was Chinese American. He was ethnic Chinese.
It's ironic that not only could they not prove a spying case against him, but they've never even shown that there was a theft of these secrets, is my understanding, that these supposedly miniaturized atomic bombs, they've never been able to show that China has them or that they was stolen from the U.S. Am I right on that?
They've never been able to make the case that anything was actually stolen, handed over. The miniaturization of nuclear weapons, so much of this is available on the internet already. It's public domain. It's scary. But how this could be identified with, you know, Wen Ho Li giving this to China, as though China is not capable itself of, you know, a number of, in Wen Ho Li's defense, a number of the of America's top nuclear scientists gave testimony to say that China is entirely capable of miniaturizing nuclear weapons on its own. They have the technology. They've had the technology for a long time, and that they did not need Wen Ho Li or anybody else to hand over codes that, in fact, were so archaic. It's kind of like handing over an original Apple computer to China and saying, okay, they developed a new, you know, miniature computerization system because we gave them an old Apple computer. That's how old the stuff that Wen Ho Li worked with was. So it's never been proven. They and interestingly enough, they've not pursued it. If the spy who gave this material to China, allegedly, was worse than the Rosenbergs, then why did they stop with Wen Ho Li? If Wen Ho Li wasn't the guy, who is? And so you have to wonder, well, was there ever really a case? If there is somebody wandering around who is that dangerous, why aren't we looking for them?
Sometimes people get discouraged. You know, you have these cases, there's injustices. The government, especially now with the Republicans in power, seem kind of all-powerful. If you had, in a succinct way, to look back, looking using the examples of both Wen Ho Li and Vincent Chan and the movements that develop around them, what can you say that like gives people hope that it is possible to fight City Hall?
Well, I think looking at both of these cases, the Vincent Chin case and the Wen Ho Li case, really do give us reason to feel that even in the face of injustice, even in the face of a terrible killing or a persecution and the naming of being a spy, that you can actually fight back. It does take people coming together. It does take a social movement. And out of those social movements come greater preparedness for the future. But that these remain as reminders that number one, the government does make mistakes, and number two, that that the people, when organized and when, you know, fighting for things like justice that we sometimes forget or seem so remote and abstract and ideal, that actually people can take that on and can defeat something that looks like a huge injustice by the hands of our government. And that's an important lesson today when we can see so many things happening and so many people are discouraged, that it really does take this kind of effort.
Excellent. That...